thanks to you.
Don't
Uncle,
lose Ricky's.
I really appreciate you coming and supporting. And
thanks, thanks, Esty. It's been a pleasure. Don't lose Ricky's number out there, 608-256-2001.
And this is WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. We have about 50 seconds for some music there, Encore.
Yeah, it's the BBC coming up next. And again, as I said, like, we have some exceptional programming at this station, not just the music, but also all the news, BBC, and then public affairs.
And you know, if you gave us money, I'd be happy to disturb or disrupt Alan. And thank you, then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, let's, you know, it's called paying it forward, right? So
yeah,
we had Tony in, so we might do the same for a public affair. But thank you once again for staying tuned in. And you are listening to WRT 89.9 FM.
And Afrotronics, by the way, who is from Chad, he did... What's the name of his song he did... Amabua. So here you are, the BBC.
Hello. President Trump has temporarily suspended nearly all tariffs imposed on Mexico. The delay on taxes, introduced only on Tuesday, will last until early April. Erin Delmore reports.
Mr. Trump confirmed via social media that goods from Mexico would receive a one-month exemption after speaking with the country's president. Meanwhile, new government data shows that imports into the U.S. increased by 10% over the month of January, as Mr. Trump took office with promises to impose sweeping tariffs on imported goods. That sent the U.S. trade deficit to its highest figure on record, at $131.4 billion. Importers appear to have proactively shipped in goods to avoid potential future taxes promised by Mr. Trump on the campaign trail.
Leaders of European Union countries have promised to stand by Ukraine as they meet for an emergency EU defence summit amid warnings that the continent is facing a moment of truth. They're discussing how to support Kyiv, but also on massively boosting defence spending amid deep strains in the transatlantic alliance. Here's Danny Eberhardt.
Displays of solidarity for Ukraine are nothing new at European summits. They're welcome relief, though, for President Zelensky, who's attending, especially after his recent bruising experiences in Washington. He thanked EU leaders for showing that his country was not alone, but he needs action. And EU leaders know they're facing a crisis that feels existential for the bloc as well as Ukraine. With President Trump's radical shift of US foreign policy and the threat from Russia, they speak of a watershed in terms of Europe taking responsibility for its own security. It remains to be seen whether they deliver.
Sudan has taken the United Arab Emirates to the International Court of Justice, accusing it of supporting the paramilitary rapid support forces in the civil war. Khartoum claims the UAE is complicit in the genocide of the Masalit community in West Darfur through its military, financial and political backing for the RSF. Richard Kagoe reports.
The UAE has strongly rejected Sudan's allegations, calling the case a cynical publicity stunt. It insists the claims are baseless and says it will seek an immediate dismissal. But Sudan's military-led government wants more than just recognitions of the alleged violations. It's demanding reparations for victims of the war. UN experts monitoring the arms embargo on Darfur have previously described accusations of the UAE smuggling weapons to the RSF through Chad as credible.
There's been a warning that Haiti is heading towards a humanitarian catastrophe amid a surge in gang violence. The medical charity MSF said fighting had left civilians trapped in the crossfire, overwhelmed hospitals, and raised fears of a new cholera epidemic. Haiti was plunged into further unrest last year when gangs launched coordinated attacks in the capital. BBC News. A lunar lander built by a private company in the United States has touched down on the moon. After a tense wait for confirmation, space experts in Houston said the six-legged craft called Athena had landed and was acknowledging commands. It also appeared to be generating power from its solar panels. It was expected to touch down near the South Pole and is carrying three rovers and a hopping drone. A court in Germany has jailed four members of a far-right group over a plan to overthrow the government. They'd plotted to kidnap the health minister in order to unleash civil unrest. The three men and one woman received sentences of up to 8 years. Officials from three African states battling an Islamist insurgency in the Sahel are visiting Nigeria to discuss counter-terrorism operations. It's the first time officials from Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger have had an official engagement with a member of the West African regional bloc ECOWAS since leaving the alliance in January. Chris Ewoko reports from Abuja.
The Sahel delegation leader, General Aimé Sampore, said they had come to discuss with Abuja the fight against terrorism. After talks in the capital, the delegation would travel to the front line and epicenter of Nigeria's insurgency, Maiduguri. Jihadi militants have stepped up attacks in the Sahel in recent months, killing soldiers and civilians. Experts are wondering what advice Nigeria, which has long faced similar security threats and failed to quell them, could offer the visiting neighbors.
Syrian forces loyal to the new government in Damascus have engaged in Latakia province with remnants of the ousted Assad regime. State TV say 13 soldiers have been killed in heavy fighting around Jabla, which is close to a Russian-controlled airbase. Monitors say government forces are using helicopters to attack targets in villages inhabited by the minority Alawite community that supported Bashar al-Assad. BBC News.
Along with our listener sponsors, WRT would like to thank our local business supporters for helping us bring you great shows like this one. We never could have made it to our 50th year without our program underwriters. When you visit these businesses, please take a moment to thank them for their support of WORT. Your acknowledgement of their support really matters. A complete list of our underwriters is on our website at WORTFM.org. Does your business wish to join the party and become a WORT underwriter? Let our listeners know you support independent media. For more information about WORT underwriting, event sponsorships, or to obtain a logo tile on our popular WORTFM app, contact Doug Holtz at 608-321-9597 or visit the staff page on our website at WORTFM.org.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to play.
And good afternoon and welcome to this, the Thursday edition, the Winter Pledge Drive edition of WORT's A Public Affair. I'll be your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. You know, we live in increasingly, I would say, pendingly perilous, possibly perilous times. And it's a time when we need your support at this station now in its 50th year as a beacon of criticism, critical thinking, opposition to the mainstream on a political, cultural, musical, on all fronts. We need you now more than ever as a, in a sense, a defense and a protection of what we do here at WORT. With me in the studio is my frequent pledge drive assistant, Bert Zipper.
It's nice to be in the passenger seat here.
Talk to us, Bert.
I agree with everything you just said. These times call for all of us to stand up, to stand together, and to go forward. And that includes with our actions, and some of those actions are donating money to support organizations that are foundational to this democracy and this effort. So 608-256-2001, a call would be great. If you're online at WORTFM.org, just click the Donate Now button. Back to you, Alan.
Oh, Esty, where'd you come from?
I just wanted to disrupt you. But no, I have one last pledge for the Hejira show, and I'll just thank this person, and then I'll leave you alone. Jeff Sheep from Madison, thank you so very much for your generous support. And stay tuned for Alan Ruff.
Our guest today is the longtime friend of WORT and Thursday's A Public Affair, John Nichols. One of the Wisconsin's best-known progressive voices, John is associate editor of Madison's Capital Times, is also the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine and the author of numerous book titles dealing with, among other topics, the state of the media system, domestic politics and history, and so on and so on. His latest, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, is titled "It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism." John Nichols, with us on the phone. I miss you in person here. Welcome to back, as always, to WORT.
Hey, Alan, it's great to be with you. It's great to be with Bert and Esty and everybody. It's always a very familial character to the show today. And we're all here on a pledge drive day. And I know that some people like that, some don't. You know, some folks aren't always sure that a pledge drive can be fun, but I promise you we'll have a fun hour, and or at least a smart hour. May make fun a little difficult, but look, we're here to emphasize that WORT is an absolutely vital force, especially now. We're seeing so much of our major media stand down and fail,
exactly,
frankly, in the face of what's happening in Washington. We're seeing the Washington Post newspaper being transformed into, you know, apparently a tribune for oligarchy. And so at a time like this, you got to look around and say, okay, where are there places where I can get, you know, real information that I need from people who are not afraid to speak truth to power, and frankly, from people who want to give listeners, folks here at Ward especially, want to give listeners the information that those listeners need in order to navigate these times and to push back against threats to democracy. So I'm really excited to be a part of today. And I know, Alan, you're going to repeat that number probably.
608-256-2001. Give us a call and speak with our people taking your pledge, your donations, your contributions. 608-256-2001. You can also pledge online to wortfm.org/donate. 608-256-2001. John Nichols, I'd like for you to frame today's discussion by sharing your sense of the big picture. Give us some of your take on what's going on. As we, you know, it's just now 6 weeks. It seems like an eternity at some level, just over 6 weeks since the second reign of Donald Trump began. After all, the rhetoric of Trump, his lieutenants and acolytes would have us believe that the offensive taking place under Elon Musk's direction to pare down and eliminate numerous federal agencies supposedly has to do with putting an end to bureaucratic waste and mismanagement, explained as the necessary first step to drastically reduce the deficit on the way to making America great again. What in your estimate is really going on?
I think what's really going on is what Senator Sanders and I wrote a book about. This is a circumstance where we see in stark relief the reality of what can happen in America, where we have a campaign finance system that allows the richest people in America to buy the most influence. Well, I mean, we've always known the possibility was there. Now we're seeing it happen. Elon Musk gave something in the range of $270 million to get Donald Trump elected president. It was very critical to Trump's campaign because Trump's campaign obviously had a lot of difficulties along the way. Musk kind of came in there and shorted up at critical stages. And he was rewarded immediately with a definitional role in the administration, a role that makes an unelected figure more influential than certainly any cabinet member. And in fact, some people would say even on any given day, more influential than the vice president, maybe even the president himself. And that, Alan, is oligarchy. It's, you know, it's exactly what we talk about when we use that word. And one of the mistakes that folks make is to assume that an oligarchy can only occur in some authoritarian state, right? An oligarchy can occur in all sorts of places and in all sorts of ways. And what we are seeing now is a situation where the wealthiest man in the world is using a unelected position to restructure our government in ways that are all but certain to dramatically benefit him and other billionaires, right? With massive tax cuts for the billionaire class, with a massive downsizing of the federal government, and frankly, the creation of a situation where even, you know, going forward, some of our most cherished programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, could be under profound threat. And so this is a very, very serious time in our history. The first few weeks of it were unsettling because the Democrats in Congress did not know how to respond. I think many of them still don't know how to respond. And people, I think, were overwhelmed by almost sort of a shock and awe situation. That's changing. Now, across this country, we are seeing mass protests. We are seeing a real pushback against what Musk is doing. And my sense is that you know, if you had me on a few weeks ago, it would have been a more dire conversation. Now, I believe that we're in a moment where we're seeing a tremendous number of people recognize that what they're getting from Washington is not what they want. And I think that will have profound political consequences going forward. Some of those consequences potentially waiting until 2026 to weaken a Trump presidency with the election of a Democratic Congress. But even sooner than that, with a circumstance that I think could even cause a few Republicans to break with Trump and recognize that attacking, you know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the post office, Amtrak, the Department of Education, and basically the infrastructure of government is not something that ultimately is a winning political strategy.
You're listening to John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent of the Nation magazine and Associate Editor of Madison's Capital Times. John Nichols, you've spoken recently about what you see as an unprecedented radical shift at the top levers of government at both the domestic and foreign policy levels. And you used the line, you said, an upending of everything coming before, more radical than what came at the beginning of Franklin Roosevelt's first term in response to the Great Depression. To what ends? Lay that out for our listeners. I mean, you touched on it, of course, this concentration of power and wealth. But give it some more context. Flesh it out a little bit, if you might.
Sure. I'm glad to, Alan. And again, remember, we're having this discussion as part of a, you know, on a day of a pledge drive. And so even as I speak, before I answer your question, tell them what that phone number is.
608-256-2001 or donate online at wrtfm.org/donate.
Thank you, Alan. And so in answer to your question about where I think we're at and kind of putting it in some sort of historical context, look, when Franklin Roosevelt became president in 1932, he was elected, he came in 1933, he recognized that the country had been, you know, radically destabilized by wealthy elites that had kind of overwhelming control of our political processes and our economic processes through the 1920s. What had they done? They had crashed the global economy and created an opening for authoritarian responses that we were already beginning to see in countries around the world. Roosevelt wanted to push back against that. He was an imperfect man. He made plenty of mistakes. I'm not, you know, one of those people that tells you Roosevelt got everything right. But what he did do was try and rebalance the circumstance and to create a situation where government delivered the services that the private sector would not, and also where government kept an eye on the abuses of the system by financiers, bankers, and others. It got so bad that Roosevelt actually was under such attack that he said, I welcome their hatred as regards the bankers and all the elites. But he ultimately succeeded in establishing the rough outlines of a not a social welfare state, but at least a basic safety net in America. Republicans, not all Republicans, but certainly right-wing Republicans have for a long time bristled at that. They've wanted to deconstruct it. They want a dramatically smaller government. Well, they would give the Pentagon anything it asked for. They don't want to have programs that make sure children are lifted out of poverty. It is simply a warped sense of how you can have a civil society. Now, again, that's not all Republicans. Historically, there were many Republicans who were strong supporters of many of these programs. Eisenhower locked in a lot of the New Deal. But you have, you know, now folks within the Republican Party who really are, you know, in the service of the elites. They want to create a situation where wealth and power flows upward, i.e. that those who have a lot get a lot more. And we've seen dramatic concentration of the wealth under Democratic and Republican presidents, let's be clear. But that concentration of wealth has now become so overwhelming, and their concentration of power, even though narrowly elected, so overwhelming and overused, that we're at a critical juncture. We're at a point where we're going to decide as a country whether we're going to maintain at least the baseline of a social safety net, or whether that's going to be deconstructed, undermined, torn up in order to enrich a very, very small number of people. It's a classic struggle, and it is a struggle that involves issues of class, race, gender, politics. You know, everything comes into this. But at the core of it, it's focused around, I think it is focused largely around Elon Musk. When you have the wealthiest man in the world literally guiding the governance of the most powerful country in the world, that's a point where you ought to, you know, kind of pull the brakes and ask, you know, is this what we want? And I actually believe a tremendous number of Trump voters, when it's put in that perspective, will say, no, that isn't what they voted for. They voted for cheaper eggs, you know. And what they're getting is, you know, a situation that's, you know, laying off national park rangers. You know, it is very serious stuff. It's a very serious time in our history. And it is a time that demands a small D democratic response, where people push back with protests, with elections, with every tool they've got. And one of the tools that they've got is to make sure that you maintain an independent media. You want to maintain a media that's willing to speak truth to power, that's willing to dig into these tough issues, and frankly, that's willing to offer perspectives that are a little different than just what you hear from the, you know, the Democratic Party's, you know, kind of weak links out in Washington. And that's why this station is so important. That's why we're on today talking about these big issues, but also asking people to call in, give what they can. And I don't care if it's $1 or $1,000, right? This is not a pledge drive at WRT. Is not about, you know, kind of telling you, oh, you have to give this. A pledge drive at WRT is saying, this is a community. You're a part of it. And whatever you bring to that community is valuable. If you can give $1, fantastic. Call in and do that. If you can give $10, $100, $1,000, call in and do that. But do it now, because we're talking about something very, very serious here. And this kind of discussion, not me, but people having this kind of discussion, needs to be supported. And Alan's going to tell you the number and whatever else you need to be a part of this.
Give us a call at 608-256-2001 to show your support for the mission, the project that is WORT now in its 50th year, needed now more than ever. Bert Zipper, we've had a flurry of pledges coming in.
We have.
A fury, really, for the beginning of the program.
A fury and a flurry. And we want to thank Roberta and Howard for the very generous donation from Madison. Karen, also from Madison, another generous donation. All these are generous. Christopher Berendt came in and with a very nice donation. And Harry Richardson let us all off. So, Harry, thank you so much. All these from Madison. All of these did not take a gift. Their gift is Alan and Public Affair and this informative hour. So join Roberta, Howard, Karen, Christopher, and Harry, and join by calling 608-256-2001 and stepping up and joining them in your support of this amazing radio station, independent media, speaking truth to power.
608-256-2001 or donate online at wrtfm.org/donate. John Nichols, I assume you watched the President's Tuesday address to Congress, the nation and the world for that matter. What messages did you come away with? Was there a particular moment or something he said that struck or surprised you that stood out?
Absolutely. I think it was, first off, it's a very long speech, 99 minutes. That's a pretty big requirement of anybody, but it happens to be what I do for a living. I write about politics. And so, yeah, I watched it. I watched the responses, et cetera. What stuck out to me was the president's focus on Social Security. And he spent a substantial amount of the speech, not any kind of anywhere near a majority, but you know, a decent period within the speech, talking about, you know, all sorts of issues, right? Some issues he gave more attention, some issues he gave less. But it's notable to me that he spoke more about Social Security than he did about inflation, as an example. And in that time that he spent talking about Social Security, it was a direct attack on Social Security, saying it was incredibly badly run, that there's all sorts of suggesting there's all sorts of fraud, saying things that had been disproven, that were in fact not right, creating false premises. And you ask yourself, well, why would a president in such a important speech, a speech that is to the whole country and is, you know, arguably the most listened to speech a president gives in the course of a year, why would he devote substantial amount of time to attacking Social Security in the way that he did? I think we have to recognize that what we have seen from the Trump-Musk administration so far is only a beginning. And in that speech, you heard a signaling, a telegraphing of a desire, I think, on the part of this administration to go after Social Security. I mean, they're already going after Medicaid. And I suspect there will be assaults on Medicare. But Social Security is usually something that even Republicans tend to avoid in any kind of overt way. I think they'll continue to do that. I think they'll continue to say, oh, we're just trying to get rid of fraud. We're just trying to get rid of waste. But the fact of the matter is that Social Security offices across this country are being shut down. People are being laid off. There are threats to the system. And when I heard that in that speech, to me, that really stood out. It's not the only thing that stood out. There's plenty more we could talk about. But if I'm going to put a line under one thing, it would be that.
You know, the actions of Elon Musk as an unelected doge at the doge, right?
Yeah.
I've marveled at that acronym. And, of course, the doge with the small d as the head of the city-state of Venice, the administrator.
It's very regal, my friend.
Very regal. Yeah. The actions of Elon Musk as an unelected doge at the doge, the stand-in commander-in-chief, has dominated much of the news cycle. He so far has had a lot of time here already, but he's not been the only oligarch busily at work transforming the political landscape. Talk about Jeff Bezos's move to purge the Washington Post of any critical opinion.
Yeah, this is a pretty interesting thing because the Washington Post is one of two newspapers in the United States that have essentially gotten a kind of top tier status, the other being the New York Times. And the Times is a bit more dominant, but the Post has been very much in the game over the last decade or so because of Jeff Bezos's investment. Daily newspapers are struggling all over this country. Many of them are shutting staff, some are shutting down. But the Post was strengthened because Bezos came in with a substantial investment and has continued to support it and strengthen it during this period. It's done a great deal of important journalism, and their opinion pages, well, you know, pretty neoliberal in a lot of senses, have been smart and sometimes very, very useful to the discourse. What Bezos is saying now is that he doesn't like that. You know, he doesn't like the opinion pages being sort of this pretty freewheeling discussion of where things are at in the U.S., and including critique of economic elites and economic power. And I went back when I was writing about this and looked at you know, some of the editorials that the Post has written in the last few years, and they've criticized inequality. They've talked about the need for serious taxation of the wealthy. They have, as a newspaper, acknowledged that we've got a situation in this country where the balance is tipped too much toward the billionaire class, too little toward the working class. They haven't always said it in quite those terms, and they haven't said it in the way that I wish they would, but they have been open to that. What Bezos is now saying is, no, he wants the Washington Post to be in favor of free markets, right? Now, you know, free markets is a pretty amorphous term, but it's usually defined by very, very wealthy people as a market where they are free to make as much money as they want. And I think everything we read into what Bezos is doing at the Post is that he wants it to become more of an advocate for the oligarchical circumstance that we are in. And he suggests that that view isn't well stated in our society, which is absurd. We have the Wall Street Journal. We have all these business cable channels and radio stations that give a very pro-corporate, very pro-billionaire class line. Now he's moving what was a somewhat independent and useful daily newspaper with a very good platform over to a place where it kind of joins that chorus in favor of the billionaire class. It's a terrible development because you and I both know people that have worked at the Post and both know that it has a rich history. But it is a reminder in this moment of the reality that much of our media is owned by members of the billionaire class, by very, very wealthy people. And you have to support media that isn't owned by the very wealthy, by the very powerful.
Yes.
And this is your chance to do it, right? This is the moment the year where we give you a chance to support WORT, which is a independent, not-for-profit community station working in the interest of democracy and a civic life, as opposed to commercial interests and profiteering.
And the darkness.
Yeah, the darkness, as they say. I said that the old Washington Post slogan was democracy dies in darkness. Now it's oligarchy lives at the Washington Post. But bottom line is that people can speak up for and support an alternative by calling in now, and Alan's going to give you the number. And this is a way to push back against the diminution of our media. We need media to have a functional democracy. People have to have information. But media is not always of the same quality. This station is of an incredibly high quality, and it needs to be supported. So, Alan, what's that number?
The number still is 608-256-2001, or donate online at wrtfm.org/donate. Bezos's purge of the opinion page at the Washington Post came in tandem with the new rules, actually restrictions, on press corps access to the White House. What does that signify to you, John?
Well, I mean, I think that you've got a White House that is, and you can like him or dislike him, but give Donald Trump credit for this. This guy understands messaging at a level that I think an awful lot of people in our politics historically have not. And what he wants is for the White House to be a platform that communicates his message without a lot of interruption, without a lot of interference. And so what you're seeing is a situation where those news outlets that ask challenging questions, like the Associated Press and others, are being kind of pushed to the sidelines, while news outlets that are going to have a tendency to be very deferent to the White House, very amplifying of the White House's message, are being brought to the front. And that's antithetical to two things. Number one, to tradition, which was that, you know, you had a White House where tough questions were asked in the press room, and presidents were expected at their best to have to answer those questions. But two, it also, it kind of undermines an understanding of the relationship between media and power, right? If media is deferent to power, if it is unwilling to ask tough questions, then it becomes something much more like stenography, as opposed to being, you know, what I think most of us understand as a desirous media, which is not always antagonistic, but willing to ask the tough questions, willing to raise the challenges, to have a real discourse. And so I think what the White House is doing right now is not just, you know, self-serving. It's also very damaging to our understanding of what an open and honest debate ought to be in the United States.
My perception of it is that it was a frontal, really an assault on the Fourth Estate, That is, that a free press, a critical press, as essential to democracy.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there are many ways that, our free press has been and is being assaulted. And we note it in circumstances like this. We note it, you know, in abusive moves by government agencies, et cetera. But we should also note the reality that our media has been dramatically diminished as corporate owners have chosen to prioritize profits over news gathering, delivery of the information that people need. And as we've seen a consolidation of media, media has become less responsible, less functional. And here's a dangerous thing, Alan. Many of our media outlets, our big media outlets, including our TV networks and that, are now owned by multi-tiered, multinational corporations, which have many, many interests. Yes, they may own a television network, but they may also own entertainment entities. They may also own, you know, factories and production centers, all sorts of other things. And so they don't just have as their interest the gathering of news and the disseminating of information. They have many, many interests, and they, in many cases, fear the Trump administration. And so you're seeing a situation where media outlets are proving to be far more deferent, even when they are allowed in the room, right? You know, and those outlets that don't tend to be so deferent, that tend to ask the tougher questions, and Associated Press has historically been one of those, are being pushed to the sidelines. Of course, it's an assault on freedom of the press. But one thing to understand is that too much of our press is willing to cooperate, right? Willing to defer. And so we've got a tough situation. We need to shore up independent, not-for-profit media. We need to shore up and support those journalists, those writers, editors, commentators who are willing to raise the tough questions. And one of the ways, of course, you know, we keep talking about it here, is to pledge your support to this institution, right? To
say 608-256-2001. You're listening to John Nichols from the Madison's Capital Times and the National Nation magazine. We got a couple people who've been patiently holding on with a question or a comment. So let's go to John. Hello, John. You're on the air. Oh, wait a minute. Excuse me. Don.
I'm Juan.
Don, go ahead.
Hello. Yes. That's me, I take it.
Yes, go ahead. Sorry about that, okay, once again.
That's okay. That's all right. It's understandable. There's a lot going on there right now. Thank you for the program, Alan, and thank you, Mr. Nichols, for your insights. I want to Trump's bad news. Don't support him. Never have. But I want to shift a little bit to the topic of the Democratic Party.
Yes.
We all know the crimes of the Democratic Party, especially since Jimmy Carter, St. Jimmy's time, and how many of the policies that the Democratic Party has followed have led us into this situation. The old saw that Bill Clinton was the best Republican president we ever, for the carrying out Republican policies that the country ever had. So here we are, and now we're looking to the Democratic Party to be the opposition party to Trump. Of course, they laid the groundwork for the rise of Trump in many ways, and all of you there know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm sure we could just argue about minutia, but the broad scope of it. And so I'm wondering what Mr. Nichols and Bert or Alan think about this situation we're in now, that we're relying on the Democratic Party to be the opposition party to this. And how do we move beyond the Democratic Party? I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. So thank you very much.
I'm going to jump in very quickly here with a very brief comment, and that is that neoliberalism, right, getting the government off our backs, quote unquote, has always been, from its inception, a bipartisan effort.
Yep.
Right? And people say, oh, Ronald Reagan. Well, Jimmy Carter was at it long before. John Nichols.
Sure. Well, it's good insight, Alan, and good insight from your caller. Look, right now we're seeing the crisis of the Democratic Party. It is unfocused. It is unclear. It has not mounted a coherent opposition to Donald Trump. It may be getting a little better now, but not much better. And frankly, it was writ large across the so-called State of the Union address, because the Democratic response to it, you know, you actually had a senator on who complimented Ronald Reagan, right? And so at the end of the day, you run into a situation where we cannot rely on the Democratic Party to be the coherent opposition that it should be, because it often agrees with the Republican Party on many economic issues. By the same token, to dismiss the Democratic Party is silly, because we are stuck, not by my choice, in a two-party system. And so the challenge in a circumstance like this is to get the Democratic Party to be an opposition. And how does that happen? Well, it's when people rise up and make their objections so clear that Democrats have to follow. It's happening right now in much of the country. The protests against Tesla, particularly at Tesla dealerships in the Tesla takedown movement, have become amazing. They are drawing thousands and thousands of people. This is a mass protest movement that targets economic power, and particularly an individual who holds a lot of economic power, the richest person in the world. And so we're seeing that. We're seeing town hall meetings where people are rising up and making demands. We're seeing all sorts of responses to what this president is doing, what Elon Musk is doing. The Democratic Party is still playing catch up, but I'll note that an independent who caucuses with the Democrats, Bernie Sanders, is out there traveling the country with an anti-oligarchy tour. He had an incredibly good crowd in Omaha about a week or so ago. Big crowd in Iowa City, in each case drawing more people than they had room for, so they had to have overflow. Thousands and thousands of people coming out there in Kenosha at Parkside on Friday night, Sanders and others. And I expect you will see thousands and thousands of people there. And then they're up in Altoona, Wisconsin on Saturday, where again, I think you'll see thousands. And so the bottom line is there's an opposition that is taking shape. The Democrats will resist being effective at most terms. But at a certain point, political reality, I suspect, will cause the Democratic Party to do a better job. I certainly hope so. And the bottom line thing that I'll tell you is what we ultimately need, along with campaign finance reform, is multi-party democracy. There's a lot of reforms this country could use to get to those reforms, to get, you know, to anything that we might want. We got to get through this moment. And so at this moment, we need a Democratic Party that is far more responsible and far more responsive than what we've got.
You're listening to John Nichols in support of this hour, in support of the station and what we do here 24/7, 365 in this pressing time. Give us a call at 608-256-2001. Online donations can be done at wrtfm.org/donate. Sarah, our producer, tells me that we've had messages to John, Don, and Ron. That was part of my confusion a little while ago. Ron has been waiting patiently. Ron, hi, you're still on the air.
Thanks. Hello, old friends. Please respond to my accusation in one news item. USA dictator Adolf II has recently joined Stalin II in the new axis for the new World War III. News item. Medicaid is used by a higher percentage of humans in red rural Republican congressional districts than in the urban core blue districts. Thank you.
John Nichols. Well, the Trump Putin question is interesting in light of the fact that lots of people have collapsed into a kind of conspiracism that Trump is Putin's puppet, or I don't know what exactly, but I hear it often.
Sure, you hear it a lot, and there's plenty of good investigative reporting on some of these issues, going back to, you know, Trump's relationship with Deutsche Bank, which had a lot of Russian investment in that over the years. So people can explore it to the extent that they want, but I think at a more fundamental level, what you have to understand is that Donald Trump tends to like strongmen. whether he's got ties to them or not, whether there's something nefarious, as some folks suggest, or not. The bottom line is this is a president who has tended to show a great deal of deference toward folks who are authoritarian and frankly, I think, you know, in deep fundamental ways, anti-democratic. And you saw that writ large across the meeting with Zelensky. And look, the Ukraine war is a mess. I mean, there are many honest debates to be had about it. But what you don't want is a situation where, you know, Zelensky came there, I think, trying to have a discussion with Trump. And Trump and Vance, you know, pretty much upended the whole thing and threw him out of the White House. Ultimately, my suspicion is that we're going to get to a place where the United States and Ukraine and Russia are talking. And we may ultimately get out of, you may get to some kind of peace. One hopes so because there's been too much dying. But it's a very, very unstable world at this point. And one of the things I focus on, though, and have written a lot about, is the need to look beyond just, you know, these questions of Trump and Putin, which I think a lot of our media loves to spend all its time on, and look at the broader reality of Donald Trump. You know, he has talked about seizing Greenland, or at least, you know, coming up with some sort of scheme to take Greenland away from Denmark, and frankly, away from the people of Greenland, who I think would like to be independent, to grab the Panama Canal, which was actually a subject of his address to Congress, to make Canada the 51st state, to make Gaza into some sort of, you know, playground for the rich, with the Palestinians forced out. You know, this is imperialism. This is classic empire building. And imperialists of the past like to deal with other imperialists, i.e., they wanted to have the big powers kind of dividing up the world. And I think you're seeing a lot of that with Trump and his deference to Putin, and frankly, his deference to other very powerful players in the world, and a disregard for smaller countries, and frankly, a disregard for efforts, historic efforts, to try and have alternatives to you know, the big powers kind of telling the world what to do. I think we're in a very, very unstable period as regards foreign policy. I think it's a very dangerous period. It's one that doesn't get enough attention, especially the territorial aspirations of the Trump administration. Again, this is something that's kind of hardwired into the sensibilities of WORT. This is a station that for years has invited people like Noam Chomsky and in the past, Howard Zinn and others, Arundhati Roy, to come on air or to be part of programs that are aired by WORT, to give a different view of how the world should be organized, a view that says it should be organized from the ground up, that the people should have the power, not billionaires, not oligarchs, not big powers. And that's really one of the most important parts of WORT, I think, and one of the reasons why I hope people will call on this pledge drive, which Alan is going to shamelessly promote.
Yes, I am. 608-256-2001. Give us a call. The pledge, you know, pledge drive responders have really, well, the response has been very good so far. So, but keep it coming, folks. Keep it coming. You know, one of the things that struck me, I watched that entire Dog and Pony show, which was called the Presidential Address, the other night.
My condolences.
Assuming that you would watch it too, and we would have something to talk about. Otherwise, I said it before, feh. But one of the things I noted was that Trump trumpeted once again this long simmering ideological war on liberalism. The difference now, those branded as liberals are no longer viewed as political opponents, as opposition or what have you, but rather as the enemy, including when at one point he talked about the enemies in our midst. He glanced over at the Democratic side. That I found chilling, this ongoing demonization of liberalism as a, you know, liberalism in some quarters, in many quarters, is a dirty word, but it's part of this generalized ideological offensive.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that, you know, look, you and I have had our critiques of liberalism over the years. And the ideological spectrum is broad. And it goes from libertarians, you know, to progressives, from socialists over to right-wingers, left-wingers. But in the American dynamic, for what it's worth, we have tended to have, you know, kind of a narrower struggle between conservatism and liberalism. And for a long time, conservatism and liberalism were defined, I guess, for lack of a better touchstone, by Franklin Roosevelt, kind of the great liberal leader, Ronald Reagan, the great conservative leader. Both of those were people who bought into institutions, right? They bought into, you know, kind of the structures of democracy. They were not, you know, perfect. Roosevelt did things that were anti-democratic, and so did Reagan. Their foreign policies, especially Reagan's, saw, you know, really ugly things that we could spend whole shows talking about. But on a domestic level, they tended to be at least somewhat respectful of their political opposition. What we're seeing now is a politics that seeks to destroy your political opposition, right? And it is particularly on the part of I think, a right-wing Republican cabal built around Trump that imagines that when you get power, you should do everything you can to make sure that you never lose power. You don't respect the processes, but in fact, you attack your opponents as somehow evil, right? And the fact of the matter is that when you get into that game, that seeps into society. It creates a more dramatic division. And, you know, the thing to understand is that the height of the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson's very aggressive efforts to create a liberal democracy in America, right? You had William F. Buckley on public television, right? And in other settings, you know, as a very conservative figure. And somehow we were able to have that discourse. Increasingly in this country, that's not the case. I don't necessarily blame politicians only for that. I think we've had a radical change in our media system, but it is something we should be concerned about, because the fact of the matter is, as a society, what you want is an honest discourse that is rooted in some measure of truth. Frankly, I'd like to see a lot of truth, and that respects that people may have differing views. In that circumstance, we can actually get progress. In a circumstance where you simply demonize your opponents, you don't get progress. At the best, you get kind of you're stuck in a status quo, which is very beneficial to the wealthy elites. At its worst, you get a situation where the balance starts to be tipped against democracy. And that's obviously what scares a lot of people right now. And so in that circumstance, again, what you need is a free and diverse politics and a free and diverse media, which feeds into that politics. I think as we've seen the collapse of a lot of traditional media and the weakness of much of the of social media platforms, you end up in a situation where things are pretty messy out there. And you look for touchstones, you look for sources of information that you know, ideally can see you through and give you some sort of accurate take on what's going on, as well as a perspective on how to think about it and how to respond. WRT has been that for 50 years, which is an amazing amount of time. And it's done so in ways that I think are really important. It continues to do so in ways that are really important. And I'll just say that, you know, this is a pledge drive, obviously. And people have lots of ways, you know, which to think about the whole thing. But let me say this. I can't think of an institution where a dollar given is stretched further than at WRT. WRT does not, you know, waste money. It's not elaborate, it's not extravagant. It's very grassroots. And so I can't think of a better place to push back against big media and big politics and oligarchy than by giving to this pledge drive.
608-256-2001. I have one more question for you, John, related to the presidential address the other night. And that is the fact that at one point he said, "I love the police. I love the police." He has a tendency to repeat himself. He also talked about the need for law and order. He didn't talk about loving the police who defended the against the Capitol insurgency on January 6th. And law and order always strikes me when it comes from uttered by power. After all, the German was Recht und Ordnung, and we know who used that one all the time. 608-256-2001. We're going to have to head toward a wrap pretty soon. Let's see. A second caller named John has a question about Trump's success of getting elected. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Is that me?
Yes.
Because that isn't my question, no.
Oh, well, go ahead. You're on. You're on.
Okay.
Go ahead.
My comment is that, daily we hear, of course, that Trump is closing this place and the agriculture office in Wisconsin is being closed. Now Social Security is being closed. Okay, so that's I'm very upset about that. However, I would like to know, and hopefully Mr. Nichols can tell me, who isn't there somebody in charge that he just can't do that? Like, isn't really the Congress in charge of these offices, and they can't just close them down? Am I wrong on that, or who is in charge?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. The moment one that has generated hundreds, probably ultimately will generate thousands of lawsuits and legal battles. Because yes, the historic sense is that the Congress of the United States has the power to allocate money and the power to direct how that money should be spent. The executive branch is responsible for the implementation, for doing what Congress has proposed to do. And so it shouldn't be possible for a president of the United States or an unelected aide of that president of the United States, who happens to be the richest man in the world, to simply cut through all these federal programs and say, we're going to shut this down, we're going to upend this, we're going to defund that, we're going to lay off people there, including folks here in Wisconsin in very unceremonious and troubling ways. And so it shouldn't be that way. So yes, you are right that the Congress should have a dramatically bigger say. Unfortunately, the Congress right now, and this is one of the challenges of the American system, is deferent to Trump, right? It is a Republican-controlled, narrowly Republican-controlled House and Senate.
Right.
And so they're not opposing as they should. And that's a really messy situation. What it means is that power's then got to go to the people, right? And people have to raise their objections to these shutdowns and to these assaults. And people need to know where the action is. And one of the answers to where the action is, where the opposition might be, is a media that tells you what's going on. WORT is such a media.
John Nichols, we're right down to the end of the wire, and I want to include some final pledging here. Bert, do you want to give our listeners a sense of what's happened here this hour?
We've had well over a dozen people contact you from everywhere from Louisville, Kentucky, where Justin says, Louisville Presente, thanks for keeping up the struggle, Alan. Greetings from Forward Radio WFMP in Louisville, Kentucky. And from Nashua, New Hampshire, Dexter
calling. Dexter Arnold.
And pledging. We've got all sorts of really old friends and comrades and colleagues and just people who are concerned about democracy. So 608-256-2001, call in with that last second pledge if you're listening.
And John Nichols, a final word for our listeners today.
It's been great to be on with you, Alan. And I love the way you run the show, and I love the openness and the deep intellect of it. And we could do a lot more, but the critical thing right now is that we've come together, a group of us, in order to urge people to support this remarkable station. You're literally broadcasting from, inside, what looks like a bunker, right? you got, the cement block behind you. This is not an elaborate station. This is not some place that burns through money. This is a place that uses your contribution in order to go to the heart of what journalism should be, and that is gathering information and getting it to the people. A contribution to WORT will never be wasted, and in these times, it's more important than ever. So if you got a dollar, you got $100, you got $1,000, call and give now. Alan's going to give you all the information you need.
608-256-2001 or WRTFM.org. Donate. I want to thank you, John Nichols. I also want to thank Bert Zipper for helping out during this pledge drive. I want to thank Emmett, our sitting in as our engineer today. It's a pleasure meeting you, Emmett. I want to thank Sarah and Shally, and especially I want to thank all of you listeners.
Yes.
Without, we can't do what we do without you.
Thank
I've
you, John.
Your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you next week. I assume we're off.
I think we are.
I'm online, and I'd like to still pledge.
Definitely. I think the pledge folks would love to take your
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show.
These workers, they rise up, and they begin this campaign that's very organized, very strategic, very tactical, and very forceful, where they, you know, threaten factory owners who have the machines that are taking their jobs with a visit from Ned Ludd. And as you said, Ned Ludd is this apocryphal figure who, you know, say it out loud next to Robin Hood, Ned Ludd, Robin Hood. This movement sort of begins in and around Nottingham, the stomping grounds of
Robin Hood. I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Hello. President Trump has temporarily suspended nearly all tariffs imposed on Mexico. The U.S. leader said he'd come to the decision out of respect for the Mexican president. Claudia Sheinbaum thanked Mr. Trump and promised to continue working with the U.S. Erin Delmore reports from New York.
President Trump says that all goods and services from Mexico that are in compliance with an agreement that already governs trade between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico will not be subject to tariffs until the 2nd of April. He announced the change on social media after speaking to the country's president, Claudia Sheinbaum. The Commerce Secretary